Welcome, everyone. Since AA's founding in 1935 by Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob Smith, Alcoholics Anonymous has helped millions of people around the world achieve sobriety. However, AA remains widely misunderstood in some circles and has been increasingly challenged by alternative approaches to treatment. My guest today, Dr. Mark Galanter, is an award-winning psychiatrist and educator in the treatment and alcohol and drug abuse world and in recovery. Dr. Galanter's recent book, What is Alcoholics Anonymous, provides an in-depth overview of this popular and established, yet sometimes misunderstood, recovery movement. Dr. Galanter is here today to help us understand what AA is, how it works, and how the organization might be considered and used by both healthcare professionals and anyone affected by the pursuit of recovery. Dr. Galanter, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you on with me.
Oh, and it's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, so this is, you know, this is so, and for me, very exciting and incredible to have a book like this available for people, because I personally get this question as a clinician and as a counselor of really what is AA about for people that really have had no exposure to it. So I appreciate you writing something like this. And I just wanted to ask you, why did you write this? And what was obviously probably from your own experience, a lacking of understanding out there?
Well, in part, it is just what you said, that there's no book out that describes AA in terms of who it helps, how it's helpful, how some of the controversies can be explained, and how research sheds light on AA's function. Surprisingly, since obviously the fellowship's been around for a long time. And also, as a physician working in the addiction field, I've been struck by how physicians, even physicians who are specialists in addiction, know much less about AA than you would think. And then it becomes clear, in fact, that people in general don't know as much about AA, and whether for themselves or for a family member or a friend, it's important that they have some idea of what this fellowship is like to see how and whether it can be helpful in treating a problem of addiction.
Right, absolutely. And I think that there, it's almost like a secret society, or almost that's how I view it at times. You know, you're not supposed to talk about, you know, who's there. It's an anonymous, you know, 12-step program. So I feel like there's a lot of mystery behind it. And, you know, for family members, I was just talking to another guest about this, family members with a loved one that goes to AA or that is in the program, they really do know nothing about it. And there's so much that they're taught in the step work that they do that really affects the family system and affects them in how they take care of themselves with boundaries, learning different ways of living and communicating. And, you know, I think that gets lost in translation for some of these families and friends of people that are recovering.
Absolutely. And I mean, if you think of somebody who's never been to an AA meeting, who walks into that universe, having no understanding of what's going on there, they should be prepared in some way for that, and a friend or a physician who has little to offer them can't very well prepare them, let alone a family member who's brother, sister, husband, whatever, is going, and they don't know what they're going to see their loved one expecting.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, there is a new, I think, trend, but there's so many alternative ways for people to get sober. I wrote a book called Rewired, and in my book, it really doesn't pertain to 12-step or not 12-step. It's just more about giving people a bunch of different options, creating their own recipe for success and recovery by discussing core values, being authentic, being honest, being, you know, having healthy boundaries and self-care. And I think it's, you know, AA does impart that kind of those core values onto people that are in that program as well. But I still feel like some of the rhetoric and sometimes the wording and the big book, which is kind of the Bible, right, for AA, for people that don't know, is a little outdated. Would you agree with that? Or do you think that it still serves a purpose?
Well, you know, I'm reluctant to be critical of the big book because it's worked so well for so many people. But I think that there are some aspects of it that are not as obviously relevant as they were then. For example, that alcoholism is a progressive and fatal disease, which is one of the tenets of AA, that emerged in the 1930s when people were subject to what would become florid alcoholism, but got help much earlier on, or themselves decided earlier on, understanding based on public information that they had to cut back. So there are a lot of people who, for whom the very rapid and serious downhill course that alcoholic people of that era suffered may not be as relevant now. On the other hand, there are people for whom it's very relevant, and it's good that the information is there for them.
Absolutely. And it does allow people to feel like they could relate to one another. They could relate to a text, to some content that maybe they've never heard before. So I do understand that. There's just a couple, you know, when I see some clients, I think sometimes they hide behind the labels that sometimes they hear, which is, I'm selfish and I'm self-centered, so I might as well just use. Or I have a disease, so I might as well just keep, you know. So sometimes I like to reframe, you know, use those kind of words and try and reframe them for that individual that maybe this doesn't, you know, this is kind of hindering more than helping. So I think that there's always so many different individualized stories when it comes to this.
Well, and then of course another aspect of the program that people will encounter very early on is the spiritual and seemingly religious quality to AA, the use of higher power and the word God in the steps. And it's been very adaptable to more contemporary thinking about spirituality and doesn't have to be seen as literal for someone coming in as it was at a time when people were more consistently and universally in the States religiously oriented. Not everybody is that way now.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so these are little things or big things that have shifted a little bit. But like you said, it's very simple, I think, to just, you know, substitute another word that works for you, or at least have an open mind, open heart to doing that. You know, don't be so literal, because these things can really help you. But I do know people that resist and say, I'm not doing AA because I don't want to talk about God, or it's all about religion. And that's not true. It's you know, it's about how you reframe it and what your perception is of it.
Yeah, quite right.
Yeah.
So they need some kind of introduction, and it's just remarkable that kind of information hasn't been available. It was quite striking. And when I first started working in the field and over time doing research on it, I would look for books that were more explanatory. And even in research that could be used to understand the fellowship. And I was surprised, given how widespread it is, how many people it's helped, how little was available.
Yeah, and do you think that is because we're not supposed to talk about what goes on in the meetings, and because it's something that people, you know, and again, and I'm just saying that this is something I hear in these communities, like it's a cult-like organization, or it's something where, you know, you don't, there's a hierarchy. There's a sponsor, right? There's a sponsor and a sponsee. There's a system. They have a system within itself that I think people find very sacred, that are part of it. They honor it. They, you know, hold it very dear to their heart, because it's probably something that's helped them get their lives back. So it's not, you know, and I did a radio show for years, called Clean Radio. I was a co-host off and on for a while. And we used to, you know, I had a co-host that wouldn't want to talk about the 12-step program for not wanting to betray other people in it, you know, not even talk about it. So again, I think that there's a lack of information out there, because I think the people that are part of AA value it in a certain way and don't want to exploit it.
The tradition, and I say tradition because that's the word applied in AA, but actually it's like the governing principles include anonymity. So people take that quite literally, and fortunately do, so they don't feel that they are going to be revealed in terms of what they talk about in meetings, and so people can feel comfortable being themselves. And also, the traditions make clear that you're not supposed to, in public media, tout the fact that you're in AA, which, again, is very good for people in recovery, because then they don't use it as an ego thing, but really just to help themselves stay sober. But nonetheless, that means that in the members of the public typically don't get a sense of all the different kinds of experiences that people in AA have. And what they do get exposed to is, more often than not, are controversies about AA and people who are critical of AA. And the members, I think, reasonably don't want to go out and publicly defend the fellowship. So we do need people who are not in recovery who can feel comfortable explaining and speaking out. And that's how I got into the field.
And what inspired you to do that? What was it that you wanted to begin to start that conversation, or at least educate people?
Well, I'm a clinician. I treat people as well as teach and do research, and it was clear how valuable AA was for many, if not all, of my patients. And how useful it was for a lot of people whom I would refer to go to AA, not necessarily in open-ended, long-term membership, where there are obviously people who benefit from long-term membership, but people who even went for a shorter period of time would get a sense of what abstinence could do for them. And it just became clear that there was an area that was really worth writing and doing research on. And the federal government, that underwrites a lot of the research and public information, isn't really oriented toward AA. And it's oriented toward medications and physiologic studies, which have their place, but not to the exclusion of understanding AA.
Right. Well, AA is more of, a therapeutic and communal, and, you know, there's so much more that comes with that. And I'm sure, though, since you treat people, you said that AA is mostly effective for most people that you treat, you must have some people where it just doesn't resonate, but there are other ways, you know, meditation, mindfulness-based things, exercising, healthy people around them. I mean, you know, as a clinician myself, I want to make sure other people understand that they can't put all their eggs in the AA basket also. Because if, you know, I had a client once say to me, I had the worst day today. And I said, why? What's going on? How it happened today? And they said, well, I had the worst speaker at this meeting. The speaker was horrible, ruined my whole day. And I said, you're going to let a speaker at a meeting dictate your day? You know, and I think that happens sometimes, is that if that's the only thing that people have in their lives that creates a feeling of safety or health, that's dangerous too, because we all have to understand how to take care of ourselves and have healthy solitude and learn new things as we become sober and on this path of recovery. So have you done also some research, or do you recommend them also entertaining other things in their lives?
Yeah, well, actually, an approach that I developed, and I've written about it, and actually I have a book on that as well, called Network Therapy, where I use family support and the support of people close to the person who may be longstanding friends to help them stabilize their abstinence. And that can be included with AA membership, but it isn't necessarily something that has to have AA as a component. And have found that a lot of people respond to getting an understanding of why staying away from alcohol or drugs is valuable to them. And then when they have the support of people who they're close to and have known for many years, that really keeps them on the right track, as it were, until they can stabilize their abstinence from the alcohol or drugs on their own. But these are people who do need to be abstinent, because if they start using again, they're really in trouble. So these are people who, for whom the kind of AA philosophy is relevant, but they may not necessarily choose to be or have to be members of AA themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And that's good to have this community support and the support of people that are healthy around you. And also, I think taking care of yourself as a doctor, I'm sure you encourage people to exercise and eat right and get to, you know, I mean, also there's a stigma around AA too that I hear all the time. It's a bunch of people sitting around smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee, which, you know, is not the healthiest visualization of a person in recovery. But at the same time, I think that that is just another stigma you see in movies or you see in media, which is not always the case, that there are some healthy people.
And by the way, it's just stereotypes like that that need to be dispelled because
absolutely
you might get the misapprehension from media or whatever that these are people just sort of hanging out and talking about how bad it was to drink too much. And it's a much more sophisticated and complicated fellowship and much more... in some ways difficult to understand than just what you see initially, which is why it was very interesting actually writing the book, because in addition to using information and experiences from my patients, I interviewed many AA members who had very different kinds of experiences in order to characterize the different kind of exposures that that one can have in AA.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, I'm so happy that you did say that because I 100% agree with you that those kind of stigmas and labels are really what creates this kind of ignorance around AA. And also just it prevents people from actually getting the help that they need. Maybe, you know, I've had clients that say like, I don't want to go there and talk about that, or I don't, you know, but that's not necessarily the experience that they'll have. So I just encourage people to go try it themselves, take action, experience it, and then you could judge, you know, then you have some...
Yeah.
Right. You have some actual reality behind
it. Which makes sense. Right.
Exactly. And in terms of the step work or the 12 steps, and for me, I find this very interesting because I look at AA as a classroom for myself when I took part in it, or I learned about it, or I went for a short amount of time. I looked at it almost like, wow, what are these amazing steps and how much value they really hold in understanding your relationship to the substance or to the behavior, you know? So how do you find those steps in, like, step one, for instance? Can you explain a little bit about why they are effective or what you found? Because I certainly think that they are.
Well, they are, and all of them have their own particular value. Like, step one is very crucial because it means that you have to acknowledge that you can't control your drinking or your drug use, and you have to turn elsewhere because it's so typical of, say, an alcoholic person when they first show up for treatment or in AA, that they figure they can always somehow in time be able to drink some. Mm-hmm. And exactly. For people who really need AA, that's a fallacy which has to be dispelled if they're going to stabilize themselves. But going through the steps, there are also aspects of it that involve really a personal transformation, which is a beneficial growth experience for people in AA. For example, looking at yourself and realizing what role you play in some of the problems you've had with other people around you, and also being more reflective and meditating as appropriate or using AA prayers, and in particularly in the 12th step when one has sort of been in the program for a while and really work their program, helping other alcoholics, because that's very important as it says in the AA book, for helping yourself as much as helping others.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're right that there is a lot, I think, of self-awareness that comes from going through the steps, because they really encourage you to take a look at all the parts of yourself, the parts you resist, the parts that are uncomfortable, the parts that which you've been basically tuning out from all these years, or from, you know, all the damage you've done. And also, I think it allows people to kind of see their trauma, if you will, and it's normalized in a sense. Not that it's you know, anything to be proud of necessarily, but that we all go through something when we are hijacked by drugs or alcohol or behavior, which you're addicted to. So sometimes your behavior is not necessarily reflective of who you truly are to your core, but yet this is what this substance will do to you. And so I feel like people finally get to see the light in a different way.
They do, and it's very interesting to first to speak with people who've been in AA for a long time and have had experiences of renewal. Spiritual awakening is something that many long-term AA members experience, and for them, it's very much a personal transformation that gives them a lot of equanimity, less distress, and more stability in their abstinence. And actually, I've done a lot of research on that and include that in the book to give an understanding of what that is. For other people who have been less involved but benefited, the social support may be the most important thing to them. And right. It's important that somebody who's going to either encounter AA or encounter family members who's in AA, they have to understand the diversity of those kinds of experiences.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no, you know, and I know also that some people think that, you know, you have to count your days when you're in AA. You have to stand up and say you're a newcomer, or you have to stand up and say that you're an alcoholic every day. And I know that there are some people that don't want to do that, that it doesn't resonate with them, and they don't, you know, that doesn't feel right. But I still encourage them. I say, you know, are you getting something from AA? And they say yes. And so maybe it's not, you know, they don't have to. That's the thing, is they don't have, there's no, even though there's rules, if they don't feel like they're, you know, that resonates with them, and they don't want to stand up every single day or count their days per se, that they don't have to. Like, I feel like that is also a misconception, and that discourages people from actually continuing on with AA, even though it has been helpful. Some of the rules, you know, don't resonate necessarily.
Yeah. And I'm sure or even that. Going there for the first time, people feel that they're going to be picked on, or they're going to be forced to speak up, or people are going to intrude on their lives. And in matter of fact, that's specifically not what AA is supposed to be about, and it's not what members are supposed to do. It's, as they say, it's a program of attraction. In other words, if you're attracted to it and you go there, then you can benefit from it, but it's not a program of recruitment.
Mm-hmm. And just one last thing about this. Did you find that people really enjoy having the sponsor-sponsee relationship, and how does that help?
Well, it's a very interesting phenomenon, because there's no doubt that people who are in AA for a long time and benefit from it end up having some positive relationship with a sponsor. But they may have, for example, one sponsor early on, and then they feel it's not really quite the person for them and may switch to another sponsor. Some may have a sponsor earlier on and then choose not to have a sponsor, and may even, having achieved long-term sobriety, kind of taper off and stop going. But by and large, for people who benefit for more than, say, a couple of months at most, they all have some kind of relationship with a sponsor to help them guide them through dealing with the steps and stabilize their sobriety.
Right. Because I think it's somebody that holds them accountable, that understands what they're going through after coming from a period of real isolation, probably, and hopelessness, and not really having anybody to be there to understand. It's a very isolating thing to come out of an addiction and not have asked for help, per se. So I think it's a wonderful relationship to develop, and also for people that have negative experiences with the sponsor, to try again. You know, sometimes it's not the right fit, but I encourage people to keep going and keep trying to find someone that will be a good supporter. So, yeah, that's fantastic. Well, Dr. Gallanter, so honored to have you on today. It was really amazing and helpful, and I love your book, and I feel like it's just going to help so many people understand what AA is all about, and hopefully continue to encourage people to find their way towards hope and recovery. So yeah. Can you tell everybody where they could find you?
I'm in New York, and I have a practice in New York. I mean, it's geographically, and the book you can find on Amazon. It's no mystery, and you just look for what is Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's right there. So you can find the book or me, and I'm glad to help people if I can. And thanks very much for having me here. I really hope it's been helpful.
Oh, it's been absolutely helpful. And this is a discussion that, you know, it's for me, I think it's an honor to have, because I feel like anytime we can have a conversation about things that sometimes don't get talked about is very powerful. So thank you so much. You're listening to Rewired Radio on Radio MD. I'm Erica Spiegelman. Thank you all for joining us today, and stay well.